Hi, I'm Corey.
I'm Bill.
And together,
we host the In Focus podcast.
Yeah, we do.
So today on the show, we have a special guest, Sergio Valenzuela, award-winning filmmaker or hermetic master of knowledge, whichever you want to refer to him as.
Depends how many mushrooms you take.
How's it going, Sergio?
It's going fantastic, man. How you guys doing?
Good. And so you are an experienced editor, an experienced director. You've done some producing.
Yes.
You've worn a lot of hats.
I've worn every hat.
And
I've even had to go get coffee for people.
Yes. So even from the ground
up. Everybody's got a PA.
And that's after
sometime.
I won an award.
Oh, man.
Hey, it keeps you humble, right?
Right, yeah, it does. It really does. Actually, what I love to say about this industry is, in this industry, it's the only industry where the guy getting the coffee on the next project, he may be the director.
That's true. Yeah, that's very true. Yeah. So remember to treat your coffee getters with respect, because you might be working for
everybody.
Them. Oh, yeah. Everybody. Yeah, not just.
And I've seen it happen, too. The kid that, just starting out, a year later, you see him and he's doing something huge, and you're like, damn, dude, that's awesome.
Yeah.
But you never know.
And you get the proud dad feeling.
Right, okay. Yeah, exactly.
He came up with me.
Boy.
Yeah. He learned from me.
Right. That's my boy.
So, Sergio, we've known each other for a while through, like, Zach Adams and a lot of the same circles. And I know you've edited some footage that I've shot over the years with Zach. When did this all start for you? When did you first decide you were interested in film?
Honestly, it probably wasn't until I got into my 20s, because my teen years, I was into movies. And I'm so grateful that I actually grew up as an 80s kid, because I got to see all the classics.
The best
Ghostbusters. Knight Rider, every 80s movie that came out.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I was part of that, all the music and everything. So I'm so grateful for that.
That was the golden age.
Big time. And so during that time, all these special effects were coming up in movies, practical stuff. So that's what I wanted to do coming up as a kid, getting into doing special effects. I look at the Joe Belasco Makeup Center years ago. Of course, this is before they were accredited or for their net. This is before they had websites and stuff like that. So you literally had to call their offices and get information, and they mail you a booklet, a brochure. Here's their stuff. And so I looked at that, and fortunately I can afford it, because since it was literally, you got to drop that full amount on there in order to go to the club, I couldn't afford it. So I got into the military to get money to go to special effects school, which I never did. I ended up becoming a filmmaker.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So originally you wanted to start in the FX world?
Yeah, I want to do FX. I want to do severed heads and monsters and guts and all that shit.
What was the
Fangoria magazine was like the best thing ever growing up. Growing up.
And then I'm sure the movie FX.
Oh, yeah. Love that movie, FX. The Deadly Art of Illusion. I remember that. Yeah.
I don't know this.
What you don't know FX?
Oh, you got to check it out. Movie. You got to check it out.
It is so, honestly, think about it nowadays and you look at the storyline, the plot to it, it's kind of way over the top stupid. Where a special effects artist is going to get involved with, like, with the FBI or CIA to bring out a criminal organization like that.
Great pitch.
But like, as a kid, you watch that, you're like, I want to be an FX artist.
Yeah.
Because they did a bunch of cool stuff there. They did this one scene where they were supposed to be lured in the bad guys. And so they pretended this girl was taking a shower, and it was all done with projections and smoke machines. And it looked like she was through the window. It looked like it was a girl taking a shower.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's so,
but
so
you're like, ooh, that looks like.
It's like a live action behind the scenes. Yeah. Like every scene, you're like, oh, that's how they do that. But then like, in your mind, that's also the movie. Like,
interesting.
It was a wild concept.
Like I said, 80s kid.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Perfect. I mean,
only true fans know what that is.
That is amazing.
Yeah, he's wearing a Karate Kid t-shirt.
Johnny Lawrence, Daniel LaRusso, All Valley Karate Championships.
That's right.
Yes.
Which I love Cobra Kai.
Oh.
I still haven't seen it. Zach keeps getting on me about watching it.
Yeah, what's wrong with this guy?
You can see yourself out the studio. Right
there. Exactly.
I know.
Screw this, I'm leaving. You want to go get some coffee?
I've not seen anything. So you went into the military to raise money to go to effects school.
Because at that time, effects school was $8,000 to $10,000. And of course, this is late 80s. This is early 90s. So that was maybe like about $20,000
Yeah.
Close to it.
Yeah.
By today's.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
And so when you got out, you didn't go to effects school, but then you got into just regular filmmaking. What were your first gigs? Like what got you into it?
I did a lot of just research and stuff, because of course back then it was all out of magazines. It wasn't, you know, as easy as it is today. Oh, I don't know how to do this. Let me get on the
go on YouTube,
YouTube, and watch a video. Ooh, now I know how to do it. So, and cameras back then were expensive as hell. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the whole process, like you couldn't just go from shoot to edit and everything same day.
Oh no.
Yeah. Like it's film.
Well, one of the things that, you know, when I got back from Iraq, but is I ended up buying, you're going to laugh, the state-of-the-art camera back then, the Canon XL1S.
Yes.
I thought you were going to say the XL2, but the XL1S.
The XL1 is
a
throwback.
That was the shit, man. Yeah, that was the shit back then. Yeah, that was the mini the DV. Filmmaker camera standard to have. That teeny tiny body and massive lens on this thing. It was so, it like, the impressive. Weight on it was just awkward.
did that one have the 24P?
No,
that was before 24. Yeah, the XL2 had the 24P.
XL2 was 24P.
But that thing, I mean, if you shot 3 hours worth of, well, you know, if you shot 3 hours worth of film, you had to sit there and digitize in real time 3 hours worth of film. And if that thing screwed up in the middle.
Play that back.
Yeah, if that screwed up in the middle.
Or drop frames.
Yeah, you're starting all over again.
Yeah.
But what the hell was my original question?
Like what were your first gigs when you
that's what we're doing. That's actually when I got back from Iraq. I got the Canon XL1. I bought a Mac. I picked up a Final Cut Pro 4 HD.
Ooh,
that's kind of a big deal. That was just had come in HD.
Yeah,
which it wasn't really HD.
That's what I started on.
Final Cut Pro 4 HD. Bought that and. Basically just ran around with the camera on my own. I didn't know anybody. Didn't know anybody in Tennessee in filmmaking or anything like that, because I had just come back from Iraq.
Yeah.
And then I'm standing at the grocery store, or at the convenience store one day, and the guy standing in line in front of me, he says, "Yeah, it was a great day today. I got shot in the back with the M16. And then he says, "We got about four more pages of script left." And I was like, bling. So started talking to him, come to find out he was retired military and he was an actor here in town. A gentleman by the name of BJ Brown.
BJ, you remember BJ,
right?
I do, yeah.
Brown, for awesome dude. Yeah. Love that dude. Unfortunately, he passed away several years ago. Mm-hmm. But I got to talking to him and we just, of course, because of the military and I had just got back from Iraq, so he was like, "Oh, hey, come on."
Yeah, yeah.
And so him and I clicked, and we started doing work together, and that's how I met Zach. I ended up putting together my very first short film ever, The Confession of Johnny Black. Mm. Did that, put that together. We shot that, and it did good.
Yeah.
It did good. It was a little film about this mafia hitman who basically comes to terms with what he's doing. He wants to get out, and he approaches the boss to, you know, "I want to get out." And so the boss basically tells him, "Hey, you know, maybe you need to go connect with God." So, of course, the guy goes to church, and that's where the hit happens. So, man, what was cool is I actually used the Catholic church downtown.
Nice.
And when the priest asked me what the short film was about, I told him, "Oh, it's about this guy who's in the mafia, and he comes to terms with what he's doing. He turns to Jesus to save himself." And he goes, "Oh,
and you didn't
okay,
tell him.
I didn't tell him he was getting whacked inside the church." So he goes, "Okay, that sounds pretty good. You go ahead and shoot it." All right. So we did it, shot it, did the death scene really quick, got it done.
This is how you do true indie filmmaking.
That's right. It's guerrilla.
Yeah.
It's guerrilla.
You didn't lie to him. You just didn't tell him the whole.
You didn't tell him the ending.
Yeah, just told him what he needed to know.
Yeah. You don't want to spoil the ending.
As a matter of fact, I don't even think I ever sent him a copy of it.
Of course not.
I probably wouldn't.
Send it now. Here you go.
Yeah.
So it's funny. Like, you and I almost have kind of the same origin story when it comes to getting into our first gigs, because BJ and Zach, they hired me for the first time back in the day. And, of course, BJ was the guy who started Skydive Films originally. And him and Zach were doing, like, Southern Haunts.
I was part of Southern Haunts, too.
PBS series. Mm-hmm. And
Which I've told him, I put a bug in his ear here lately. I was like, man, you need to revamp that and bring it up to modern times instead of having that 90s look, and let's redo it and redo it scary.
Yeah.
Like, that might be something we do. Of course, we're all doing separate projects now.
Yeah.
That would be so cool.
And for those who don't know, I think Zach mentioned it in his episode, but Southern Haunts was a series about different hauntings around the South that ran on PBS.
Not just around the South. It was specifically historic locations.
Right, right.
Yeah, specifically historic locations. Like a
haunted vibe or haunted.
Yeah.
Actually, we did this place up in Franklin, Kentucky called the Octagon House. And it's actually one of like three buildings in the U.S. that's octagon shaped. That's actually a brick. I think there's like 200 and some odd buildings like that. That's that specific structure.
Yeah.
But they're all made out of wood. And these ones are particularly just made out of brick for whatever reason. Makes them extra special for whatever reason.
Yeah.
But we went and shot there. Of course, we're walking around getting B-roll footage. We did the interviews, the B-roll footage, walking around.
Yeah.
Well, I'm walking around and, I walk into what's supposed to be the nursery, and as soon as I walk in, the color on the camera, the room looks pink.
No.
And I'm like, what in the hell? So I walk out of the room, and everything looks fine, and I walk back in, so I'm adjusting my settings, thinking maybe it's the window pane, maybe something.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe the paint, something. I'm like, what the hell? So I called the other camera operator that was with us. I'm like, hey, man, come here, bring your camera over here. So he brings it in, same thing. Well, what in the hell? Why has this got this pinkish tint? Mm-mm. We couldn't figure it out, but we checked every other room, nothing, but this one particular room, pink tint on the walls. And so we're sitting there messing with this, and then the lady that owned the building, she comes over, she's like, what's going on? And we're like, this room, it's, the cameras are acting weird. Every time we walk in here, the walls turn pink, but if you're standing outside, they look fine, but as soon as you step in that threshold, they had this pink tone to them.
Oh, weird.
And she goes, oh, this room's really weird. She's like, there's noises that come out of this room when there's nobody in it. And then once a year for, I forget what she said, a week and a half or 2 weeks, the windowsill just gets covered with thousands of flies. Like in the movies, like when you see like just flies.
Oh, man.
There's no explanation for it. They've had they've scoped the walls. They brought in cadaver dogs to see if there's anything dead in the walls. Nothing. Just literally this particular time of year, it doesn't fail. Boom. Suddenly just the window gets covered with flies. For whatever reason.
I feel like I'm sure there's like a scientific explanation for the time of year and maybe there's a leak. But the fact that when you walk into the room and like the camera's like all.
The camera gets all messed up.
I'm a hard pass. I'm good.
Well, right around the time we were doing that, we had another buddy that was into ghost investigations and stuff like that. And he says to me and Zach, he says, hey, man, we got this house. It's really, really haunted. Stuff happens all the time. And, of course, we're like, oh, that might be pretty cool. And then he says, yeah, we just found out it might not even be a ghost. It might be a demon. We're like,
no.
Ghost is stuck where it's at. Demon can follow your ass wherever you go. I'm like, nope, I don't think so. No,
oh, man. We're good.
Not at all. Oh, come on, man. It'll be fun. I was like, nope. Hell no. Here's a camera. You can borrow it. That's the red button. Press it.
All right. That's Sergio's limit. Do almost anything for the shot, but demons.
But no demons.
No demons. Right.
Demons can be offset.
I'll hang off a bridge upside down. I mean, okay, it's demons.
No. So most of what you were doing early on was both shooting and editing?
Early on, I did a lot more editing than I did shooting. Because everything that Zach, BJ, and the small group of friends that we had at that time, I was basically really the only editor in the group.
Yeah.
Which I didn't want to be honest with you. I hated editing.
But for the simple fact
that everything was on Mini DV, and you're you just handed me 8 tapes.
When you mentioned digitizing footage, I hadn't thought about that in a long time because I've tried to block it out. Yeah. I mean, that was awful.
That
just
was real
time digitizing footage. The kids now, they're lucky.
Oh.
They're lucky they don't have to sit and
throw in a card, start editing.
Yeah.
Done.
That's awful, man. Like digitizing. Well,
about right before Corona hit, I was going through doing my shelves, and I literally found a bag in the back corner that basically had all the Mini DV tapes that we did back in those days.
Yeah.
And it was a huge bag.
Yeah.
Probably about 30 tapes. And I think at that time, Zach was still doing the kids film course down in Franklin during the summertime that he used to do.
Yeah.
And he said something about tapes, and I was like, oh, here you go, man. Just have these blanked out. And he goes, holy shit, where did you get these? And he starts going through them, and he goes, wait a minute, this is Southern Hearts episode 2. This is this, this is this. He's like, damn, I haven't seen any of these. He's like, in forever. And he's just pulling them out. He's like, damn. He's like, wow.
These are my tapes.
Yeah.
This is my history.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've got the same. I've got like a huge duffel bag in my gear closet full of mini DV tapes.
Yeah. I finally just was like, I don't even have a mini DV camera, so I'm just get rid of them. I don't plan on saving. It's not like your home movies where you're like, oh, you know.
No, it's early gigs.
Yeah, it's early gigs.
Way less sentimental. Probably more heartache and like bad memories of this was a terrible experience.
Well, I just watched The Confession of Johnny Black a few months back. It's the first thing I ever did. Mm-hmm. And I'm just sitting there just cringing going, what the fuck was I thinking doing that show?
Hey, you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, you do. But it's the whole fun of the whole process. You know, one thing that I really, really do miss about those early days is walking on set and everything just seems so magnificent and just, you know, that feeling when you first walk on the set. You see it on people that have never been on set and you invite them on set and you're like, they walk in, they're like, whoa, this is so cool.
Yeah.
I miss having that feeling because now I'm like walking, I'm like, all right, when you start shooting about 30 minutes, this, and this, and you're like, damn, I kind of miss that feeling.
It becomes normal.
It does, it gets normalized.
Demystified.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The magic.
Yeah, it really does. Yeah, I do miss that.
Have you ever considered going back and reshooting first shoot? No.
Hell no. No.
Well, I was going to say, have you at any point decided to revisit effects work?
No, because the footage that went along with it sucked as much as the effects did. So, no.
Well, I mean, just like in general, like you were interested at one point in going into effects. Like, have you ever thought about exploring that again?
Not really, no. No, it's never really crossed my mind. I mean, I love watching horror movies and sci-fi. Sci-fi is my genre. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, no, I just kind of just get lost in it, and I don't really just, you know, it's not like when you're watching a movie as a filmmaker, you're like, oh, look at the, I wonder what that light, what kind of lighting they're using on this and that type of stuff.
Yeah.
Now I watch sci-fi and horror movies, I just watch them for fun. That's not like, I wonder if they use this kind of latex.
A good disconnect.
That's good to have that disconnect.
It is.
You still enjoy stuff.
Sometimes it's hard. So it pisses my wife off because I'll be like, oh, did you see that cup? It was half empty and now it's full. And she's like, I don't care. Just watching a damn movie. You
know? Where was the script supervisor?
Right? Yeah. No doubt. He's fired.
So when did Iron Will come about? And what was the kind of the inspiration behind that?
Iron Will, we were actually editing Hunger in America.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, Hunger in America, and when Zach brought the Iron Will project to me.
Okay.
He said, man, he had just finished doing a music video for Stephen Cochran, Pieces.
Oh, right, yeah, right.
He's a veteran, of course. He's big in the veteran community. And after Zach worked with Stephen, of course, he got to hear all this stuff. Well, not only to Stephen, but Sal Gonzalez. But he got to hear all this stuff about post-traumatic stress disorder and veterans committing suicide and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
And of course that flipped the switch to him that he was like, man, I got to do something about this. Mm-hmm. And so he approached me. He's like, man, you're a veteran. You're a filmmaker. You got a unique perspective on this. I want to put this together, but I want you to direct it.
Yeah.
And at first I was kind of hesitant. Of course, we were in the middle of another project and I'm not thinking about, you know, starting a whole other one right in the middle of this.
Yeah. Right.
And then the other thing too, I knew as a director specifically especially since I knew the content, I was going to have to really kick open some doors that I don't know if I was ready to.
Yeah.
Just because I have a dealing with post-traumatic stress and combat and all that stuff. And
yeah,
finally, I said yes, and we got the ball rolling on that. And one of the things that, because I had seen other documentaries about veterans with post-traumatic stress and everything else, and decent. If you know a lot about post-traumatic stress. And then one of the things that I kept hearing about from people was, or from other veterans was, I don't understand why people don't understand me. I'm talking in English. I don't know what. And so I kept hearing a lot of this, I don't understand.
Yeah.
And honestly, from both sides, from veteran sides and from family sides. And I started really thinking, why in the hell don't people understand this? I mean, we're speaking English. I mean, it's right here on the table. And then I realized people don't know shit about us. As far as people know, you join the military, you take off to basic training, you run around a lot, you shoot some weapons, and you come out, you know, a couple months later, and boom, you're a soldier. That's honestly all that people know.
Yeah.
They don't know about the conditioning. They don't know about the mindset. They don't know about the camaraderie. They don't know anything.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the things that I was like, this movie has to have that, because it has to have an explanation of who we are and why we are. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the big things in the beginning where we start talking about the reasons he joined the military. And it's everything from family tradition to 9/11 to, hell, I live in a shitty-ass neighborhood. I have no way out of this.
Yeah.
You know, and even stories, I have kids. I got to take care of them. You know, little things like that. So it spans.
Yeah, there's so much to the makeup of the individual versus just the outcome of the post-traumatic stress.
And literally, and then the other thing we also explain too is that you see it firsthand in the film is going through basic training, taking a snot-nosed civilian kid that doesn't know his head from his ass. And, you know, 2, 3, 4 months later, depending on what your job is, boom, you got a hard charging killer.
Yeah.
Because honestly, I mean, that's what soldiers are. You're a killer. You're, and they tell you this in the military. Doesn't matter what your job is. You can be communication. You can be intel. You can be infantry. Your first job is a soldier.
Yeah.
That's your first job, to kill the bad guy, to protect us. Yeah. That's your first job. So, and it's really the process of turning a civilian into that that we show in the film. And then, of course, we start getting into deploying for the first time, what that was like, making contact for the first time, what that was like, and basically from start to getting all the way back home, and then everything else that happens getting home. So we laid it out really, really well.
Yeah.
And see, I think, like, and I think that film resonates a lot because it was directed by you, who's gone through that process, and you know, you understand it from, it's not just some random director off the street that doesn't fully understand it trying to tell a compelling story. Like, you lived it. So you can see that in the film for sure. Like, it's definitely got that.
Well, one of the things that got a lot of the really good conversation out within the interviews was right off the bat, I realized that in dealing with veterans, I couldn't sit there and do like a regular interview like you and I.
Yeah.
I had to literally sit there and get out of my box and honestly just make it like if it was just two buddies hanging out having a beer.
Yeah.
And that's our conversation.
Yeah.
And it was natural. Mm-hmm. It just flowed beautifully because it was two guys hanging out.
Yeah.
BSing about the shit that bothers us.
Yeah.
You know, from coming back. And it was beautiful. Boom, boom, everything just laid out. Actually, a lot of the guys told me that some of the stories that they told, that was the first time telling those stories.
Oh, really?
Because they were so comfortable to tell that story. Because one of the big reasons veterans don't tell stories to civilians is because, number one, you're not going to understand the magnitude of the story. Number two, you end up getting interrupted a lot by people asking what military acronyms are. Because you talk in a military term.
Right.
You use acronyms. You talk military terminology. And before you know, people, what's that? What's that mean? What's this? And you're like, well, hell, man, I'm not even getting my point across.
If I have to explain the details of the story, you probably aren't going to get the story.
Yeah.
And so these guys were like, no, you made me feel comfortable. And then Chris Krieger, who's in the film, who actually has an organization that provides service dogs to veterans, the story he told, he said that was the first time he's ever told it out loud.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and actually in his interview, he got so emotional, we had to stop the cameras and give him a 5-minute break. And luckily enough, the camera operator that I had at the time, which Mike Stryker was DP, but at that moment, Micah Ellers.
Yeah,
he was a camera operator at that moment. And I'm so grateful for him because he was so smart at that moment, because I said cut, and he didn't cut. He left it rolling.
Oh,
yeah, so that section that you see me get up and actually give Chris Krieger a hug,
that was actually what we caught
afterwards. And I thank you, Micah, for that. It was awesome. He was on his toes for that. Yeah, that was very powerful. And after I realized that he had captured that, I was like, oh, my God, thank you so much. You rock, dude.
Yeah. I had a similar experience when I did Hear Me Now, the bullying documentary, because that was something I went through. So when I would talk to these people who have never, a lot of them were shy. They didn't want to share their story of getting picked on and being suicidal and all that. So I would start, like you said, like having, like almost like hanging out, having a beer. Like I'd just talk to them about my story and just get one-on-one and personal with them. But I'd like secretly of the camera rolling, just in case they started opening up to
just
me.
Just in case.
So that's how I got a lot of.
Well, that's one of those things that you learn from experience, because I've seen, you know, young filmmakers that are like, action, cut. As soon as the actor finishes saying cut. I'm like, what are you doing, dude? You're on an SD card. You literally have hours to shoot.
Always be rolling.
Yes, and that's one of the things, that comes with experience. Just let it roll.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you never know what you're... It's when... Especially when you're dealing with regular people that aren't actors, that aren't performers, you're putting them on the spot. So if they feel like they're on the spot, they're probably not going to give you the good stuff. But if they're relaxed with you... I mean, that's definitely a pro tip for anybody doing documentary or like corporate work or anything that's not like professional talent.
Yeah. It's, you're not running rolls of film. Like it's safe to get a little extra. You know, I think the other thing that you mentioned, and we talked about this with a prior guest, just talking about like the decision of whether or not to engage specifically in a documentary, but it could apply to any projects, is there's, like, you have to be cognizant of the emotional connection that you have to the story that's going to be told. And it sounds like in this instance, like, you weren't immediately like, yes, I definitely want to do this, because, like, to your point, it was going to open up some doors that you had already closed or either weren't ready to open up. And I think that's for filmmakers that specifically want to work on projects that are maybe their social impact or there's some sort of narrative or documentary style, like, telling a real life story versus something that maybe makes sense from start to finish. You know, I think the thing Barrett said was life doesn't always make sense, and that can make it really difficult emotionally to tell a story like that.
Yeah.
I think some of the best documentaries out there are the ones where the filmmakers get really involved with the subject or, you know, what's going on. Actually, one of the finest documentaries to watch, which it's honestly, it's a train wreck and a half. You ever watch The Wonderful Whites of West Virginia?
Yeah, I haven't seen it, but Mike Stryker shot a lot of it. We talked to him about it.
Yeah. Oh, my God. If you've ever met Mike Stryker, he's the most awesomest, just the most. He
just
is
a
like
sweet guy.
Sweetest, just like innocent. I mean, just he's like a big kid that's so he innocent. I love him. But to know that he's associated with that film just makes me laugh so much.
Some of the stories he told just...
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, wild. He told them on the show.
Yeah.
He
told me that some of the craziest stuff didn't make it into the documentary.
I can't imagine.
He told me that there was one night that a couple of the family members got into an argument, and so they just pulled out guns and started shooting at each other. So here's camera operators, boom operators diving over cars, behind walls and stuff, while these two fools are sitting there busting caps at each other.
Oh, my God.
I just know, Mike, he was just like... There was just a lot of interesting stuff that happened. Yeah, that.
Just
like,
really that's casual.
Just kind of how
really
he put it. It's
reserved
like,
about it.
Yeah, yeah. He's so he hates talking about that food movie too. He's like,
yeah.
A lot happened.
It was an experience.
Yeah, I'm sure it was. Yeah.
So Iron Will, you had quite a bit of success with Iron Will awards. You were on the news, weren't you? Like
did a few news things. Got a couple of awards for that. We got Minnesota Film Festival. We walked away with the People's Choice Award.
Nice.
And then SAMHSA, which they're like a health organization type of thing. They have an awards thing. And that particular year that Iron Will came out, they were doing mental health for that year. So that's how the reason we ended up getting Iron Will into the SAMHSA Awards.
That's good timing.
And so we ended up, it was perfect timing. So we ended up getting an award from them for that.
So. Awesome. And so have you heard, since Iron Will's been out, have you heard from veterans or anybody
Actually,
who have
Iron
seen
Will's
it?
Not out yet.
Oh, really?
Nope.
Really?
Yep.
What's what?
Just on the. Ooh.
Is it a? Has it been a process?
No, Gideon Entertainment bought it from us to distribute it, or not to distribute, to get a distribution deal. Uh-huh. And of course, this was before Corona. This is right after we finished the movie. They bought it from us. They were going to do a instead of just putting it out there and just boom, here's another documentary on post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
They were trying to get a campaign together and take it to VA centers and medical centers and military bases and really get it out there and really, you know, do a huge campaign behind it.
Yeah.
And they were trying to get the film itself onto Netflix, and then something happened where it kind of got delayed, and then a bunch of other delays, and then they had almost a distribution deal, but then the distributor wanted to edit it way down, and they were like, no, we're not going to do that to this film, because we need... Actually, there's probably about another 30 minutes that should have been in the film, but we obviously trimmed it down for time, so that's why I believe it's at an hour and a half now.
Yeah.
And so... But that's where they've been, is back and forth trying to get this distribution deal. And, of course, right as they were getting ready to get one, Corona hits and everything just falls apart.
That's crazy.
So it's been almost 4 years since we finished that, close going on five.
And so it's made the rounds on some festivals.
It's made the rounds on some festivals, yeah.
It's I just assumed it was out just because I mean I was at the premiere and I've seen cuts of it and everything, so I guess I have the inside.
Honestly, I haven't watched it in a couple of years, to be honest with you.
Yeah, it's been a while. I mean, that's a shame. It needs to be out there. It's very good. And honestly, that goes to show, we've talked about this too, is distribution it's a lot.
Yeah.
And it can be a mess. And it mostly is a mess more often than not.
And, well, that's the thing, you never know, because Iron Will, Zach and I were like, for sure, this is going to get huge distribution.
For
it's
sure.
It's going to hit huge.
Yeah.
Boom, there it is on the shelf. And then another movie that we worked on that we thought, this isn't going to go anywhere.
Was it Balancing the Scales? Yeah.
This doesn't go anywhere. And boom, it hits huge.
Yeah.
You know, so you never know.
Well, it's just like...
Balancing the Scales was an interesting project to work on.
Yes, we'll get to that in a second. But with Iron Will, it's like, because I know Tim Van Esteeg, I worked with him briefly. Yeah. He gave me a lot of distribution advice that was really helpful when I was...
Yeah, I missed that dude. He was awesome.
Yeah, when I was trying to get Hear Me Now out. And just for the audience, Tim Van Esteeg was a producer who was living out in LA at the time and worked with a lot of us in Nashville, and just like a great dude, hustler,
awesome dude.
Just hustled all the time, all day long. I don't think the guy slept. Like, he was always working on something.
Nice.
And he was like, if he said he was going to do something, he did it.
Yep.
And he called me to give me some advice about distribution, because Zach was like, you need to talk to him. He's got some words. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember the first thing he said to me, you know, he talked real fast and he was real excited all the time. And he was like, the thing you need to understand about distribution is no matter what you do, you're going to get fucked. It just, you have to decide how big or how little you're going to get fucked.
Yeah.
And I was like, thanks, Tim. I'll keep that in mind. So all that to say, like with Iron Will, I mean, it's that same thing. It's like you never know what's going to happen. And it could be the greatest film. And Iron Will is fantastic. Like, it's a really good film. And it's just like they get locked up in the business side. Mm-hmm. And it's intimidating for us as creative people to even be a part of that. But then it's such a letdown when you do have this great product and it gets hung up somewhere in the business side, which it just sucks. I hope it gets out soon.
Like, I hope so too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause it's definitely a documentary. I should have been out there already helping people out. Cause Absolutely. That was the whole purpose of putting it out, was to, you know, help veterans with what they're dealing with, but help also families and friends understand what we're dealing with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you know, it was put in a perspective where you can easily understand and easily connect with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the people that I have seen it so far, that's what they come away with. You know, there's more, you walk away with more of understanding on both ends.
Yeah. And me, like somebody who's never been in the military, like I understood it a lot more after watching it. I mean, I thought it had a great impact.
Well, that's one of the things when we go back to when Zach and I started up early on and I was doing all the editing. I hated all the editing.
Yeah.
Honestly, I hated it, but at the same time, I'm so grateful for it because it's actually made me a much better storyteller.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I mean, I couldn't even begin to imagine how much shit I've edited over the years. I mean, but now it's a lot easier for me to look at footage and piece a story together.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that we ran into with Balancing the Scales.
Yeah.
Yeah, with that one. And then Price of Legacy, too.
Yeah.
We ran into trying to figure out some sort of storyline because... Honestly, footage and the way things were laid out were kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
So you kind of got to go through all this BS pretty much to find the good stuff.
Yeah. So let's talk about balancing the scales.
We have to.
Zach. Yeah. Zach talked about it a little bit. He said, you know, like anybody, honestly, that's an editor who has to edit footage that they were not on set for, I have so much respect, because that shit's tough. Like you said, like forming a story out of stuff you've never seen before, yeah. Material you've never worked with. Like, talk about balancing the scales, because Zach talked about just how much, how long.
Yeah.
How many for the listeners that can't see Sergio's face, this is,
yeah.
I feel like this is another door he's not ready to open.
I'm gonna need some whiskey after this.
Yeah, yeah.
Honestly, overall, the movie turned out to be really good. The documentary actually turned out to be really, really good. But
yeah.
The process of getting it there, oof, was like pulling teeth. Because the producer, so the director and the producer, husband and wife, Sharon and her husband, John, they're lawyers. They're not filmmakers. Never did anything with film.
Yeah.
She started balancing the scales back in the 90s.
Right.
Interviewing all these female attorneys. And stuff, did a bunch of shooting back then, stopped the project for, God, a decade and a half, and then picked it back up again with Zach. Zach came on board to help her out and stuff.
Yeah.
And so they shot a bunch of other stuff. And actually, a lot of it was with the same attorneys, but now those same attorneys that were just up and coming back then are now, like, justice of the peace, or, like, they're on the Supreme Court in Georgia, or they're, like, huge people. And so, but... Them not, I mean, there was hundreds of hours of footage. Oh. And it's one of the problems that I ran into going through this footage was them not being first-time filmmakers, their questions were not organized and like how we have it organized. You know, like anytime Zach brings me a documentary or anybody else that's in the industry, I know for a fact that all the questions are going to be the same and it's going to be laid out A, B, C, 1, 2, 3.
Yeah.
And you have a flow.
Yeah.
You know, unless you get a specialist or something and you have a specific type of question for them.
Yeah.
These questions were all over the place. Like one of the clips that I started watching, I'm sitting there watching this, and it starts off talking about lawyer stuff. And then the lady she was interviewing says something about living on a farm. And then for the next 45 minutes, we didn't talk anything but farm and chickens. Oh, that's awesome. You had 5 dogs. What were their names? Oh, you had chickens. What colors were they? Oh, did they, you know, drink the poop? I mean, 45 minutes of this. And I'm like, oh, I mean, and there was a lot of stuff like that.
Yeah.
And because you were not involved in the project at the time as the editor, you have no choice but to,
have to sit there and watch it. Because there might be like a single 2 sentences right in the middle of all that connects this to this. And you have to sit there and watch it. I'm like, oh. But, and then the other problem that we had with that, putting that documentary together, was them not being first-time filmmakers, or them being first-time filmmakers and being attorneys, they were looking at the edit as attorneys. So there was overkill on information. It was literally, the narrator would be like, hi, this is Justice of the Peace, Barbara. And then the next shot would be like, hi, I'm Justice of the Peace, Barbara. The lower there'd be like, this is Justice of the Peace, Barbara. and then like 5 minutes later, so, you know, Justice of the Peace, Barbara here. Da, 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 and it's like, no, this is, it took us forever to make them realize this is not a deposition. This is not a trial.
Yeah.
This is a documentary.
Very different.
We don't want people to watch this.
Yeah, we don't need the same thing in here 5 times.
Yeah.
2, 3 at the most. It'll stick. And then some of the other stuff we ran into, which is funny thinking about first-time filmmakers, I mean, literally, that have never done anything.
Yeah.
Some of the questions that we got, like I'd put a shot of, because they were from Atlanta. I'd put a shot of Atlanta in there, and it was a shot from like the 90s Atlanta.
Yeah.
So it looked like old VHS video. It fit, whatever.
Yeah.
Man, how are people going to know that's Atlanta? I'm like, what do you mean? Well, there's nothing on the bottom that says Atlanta. How are people going to know? I mean, people might want to start questioning the footage in the documentary. And I'm like, I have never in my life sat there in a documentary and watched the whole thing and had somebody go, I wonder if that was actually London.
Yeah.
I wonder if, and I'm like, that is not going
to
happen.
Because in the context of the story at the moment, we know we're talking to someone from Atlanta.
Yeah, yeah. So automatically your brain goes,
like, oh, okay, that's Atlanta.
But it's they couldn't grasp Atlanta. It. It literally, this documentary was supposed to take us about 9 months to cut with all the footage and everything. It took 2 years. Oh. It took 2 years. It wasn't until the partway into the second year, maybe like a year and 3 months into it, that it finally clicked to them. Oh,
I think that's when Zach stopped doing mixers because he was just in the trenches,
so ingrained in trying to get that.
What he should have done is had more mixers and had more alcohol. That would have helped. No, but that's how that one went. But honestly, pulling teeth throughout the whole thing, so many things just not working right. But what we ended up with was a fantastic documentary. It's made the rounds all over the world. And I say world because
legit,
it's been showed all over Europe to different law firms out there, all the female lawyers. I mean, honestly, all the law firms love it.
Yeah.
Just because it literally tells you, hey, these great women that have come up and are better than a lot of these male attorneys get the shaft. Yeah. They get paid thousands of dollars less just because they're women. And it's pretty interesting. We did it in a way to where it keeps your interest. Because I've told people, I did a documentary of women in law. And they're like, oh. There's nothing about that sounds interesting at all.
Yeah,
but when you watch it, you're like, oh, this is pretty interesting. Because we go back and touch a little bit on, you know, when they did law in the 60s and 70s. It was completely different. Where literally, you know, your boss could slap you in the ass. Pah!
Yeah.
And you couldn't say a damn thing about it. You know, and if you did, adios.
Yeah.
You're gone. Wow. Yeah. So completely different. Yeah. But it talks about all those early years and then what they had to go through and then, you know, where they're at now, which, I mean, some of the journeys that these women took to get to the position, they're amazing women, to be honest with you, to come, especially in the South. There was one, she's on the Supreme Court, black lady, and she said when she got into law, of course, this was like back in the 80s, she said it was tough, not only because you're a woman, but because you're also black. Now she's on the Supreme Court. She's amazing. Like, she's like the, actually for a while, I forget for what years they were, but she was like the whatever Supreme Court judge for Georgia for a while.
Right.
Yeah. Wow. Awesome.
Yeah.
And that's, I know that's been out on national PBS. Yeah,
PBS, it's been, and then the Sharon and John, the producers for that, have actually have taken it across the country, and they do presentations at law universities, like law, and they actually do it for law firms also. There's law firms that'll hire them, and they'll come in and show the movie and talk about everything. I mean,
that's awesome.
Yeah, they lay it out, and they've gone international with it. And what the funny thing is, they're doing so well with it, but they still don't have distribution.
That's crazy.
They're not even worried about distribution because they're getting it out there to the people they want to get out to.
Doing it their way.
They're just hustling it themselves.
Yeah, they are, which they're making a killing doing it, and it's getting out there, and it's getting some serious, really good recognition, which, you know, it's funny because they don't have distribution, but they're doing it.
I know. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's crazy how this industry works.
You just never know. It's unpredictable. And so similar to balancing the scales, Price of Legacy, which was another case where it was a lot of footage from a crew that you weren't a part of, that you and Zach came on board and you had to make sense of all this footage. Like, talk about Price of Legacy some.
Price of Legacy. Originally, I wasn't even the director on Price of Legacy. I got hired by Tim to organize all the footage from the original shoot and basically put together the Premiere Pro project file and get it all together and then have it also transcribed. So while we're doing all that, Tim's working with Chance Leonard and Bruce, and of course he's planning it out. Okay, the next step is this, and laying it out for them. And while all that's happening, Tim passes away.
Yeah.
And so he passes away, we find out, and I lose contact with Chance and Bruce for like 3 or 4 months. And because my only contact was through Tim. Mm-hmm. And so 3 or 4 months go by and I'm kind of start realizing I got all this footage to this wrestling documentary. What am I going to do with it? So yeah. I start going through all these old emails, can't find any contact information. And just by chance, I happen to look one of those early emails. And I think Chance's information just happened to be on there. And
yeah.
Of course, I call him up. And it's funny because I called him up to find out what the next step was. And he goes, man, he's like, I had no idea how to get a hold of you. He's like, literally last night, I prayed all night for something to happen, somehow get in contact with you. And here we are, 9 o'clock in the morning, you're calling me.
Wow.
And I was like, no way. It's kind of freaky. I was like, oh, okay, cool. Wow. And so we got to talking. What do you want me to do with this? What are you gonna? He's like, I don't know, man. We're still trying to figure it out. After losing Tim, we just kind of don't know what direction to go.
Yeah.
We're looking at a director now. And I can't remember the director's name, but he's owns the same company, part of the company Adam Carolla owns, their production company. And for some reason, they were talking to him, and for whatever reason, they decided not to go with him. And they still couldn't figure out what to do. And then I put the bug in his ear. I was like, you know what? I have a good idea of what the footage looks like. It's, you maybe have 40 to 60% of a documentary here. Because that was the unfortunate thing about the original footage. It was the same thing as balancing the scales, where the interviews were all over the place.
Yeah.
There was no structure to the interviews. It almost felt like they grabbed a bunch of film students and said, go shoot me a documentary on wrestling and bring me back the stuff.
Oof.
And so I had just mishmash of stuff. I mean, and even some of the interviews were like, really all over the place. Like there was one interview, it was like about a 40-minute interview with the sheriff of Perry, which he was the one that, for most people that don't know this, Perry, Oklahoma was where they caught Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber.
Okay.
And this particular sheriff was the guy that actually pulled him over and arrested him.
Oh, wow.
And so there for like a 40-minute interview with the sheriff on Timothy McVeigh.
Which has nothing to do with wrestling.
Now, if we were doing a documentary on Perry, Oklahoma, the town. Yeah. Yeah, totally. But he has nothing to do with the wrestling. I put a little blurb in there in the documentary itself where it says, Perry, Oklahoma was also the home or where Timothy McVeigh was captured, the Oklahoma City bomber. Boom, that's it. Done. So that way people know, oh, okay. So I stay with that.
Yeah.
And, but what is it? Damn it, I lost my train of thought.
So you have all this footage from all over the place.
All over the place.
Got to form this story.
About 30, 40% of it done are basically there. Interviews were just all over the place. And then so I put a bug in his ear. I said, you know what? I'll tell you what. I'll come out here and reshoot some of this stuff and do the post-production for this amount, which is way less than the original expense. And so, they had a little powwow about it a couple days later. Okay, let's go for it. And so I started laying it out, what I wanted to do with the documentary and stuff like that. And one thing, originally the documentary was supposed to be very ESPN expose type of sports documentary.
not a good feel.
No, no, I hate those things. Because to me, it reminds me of those old NFL movies that they would put out right after the Super Bowl.
It's like a hype movie.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Literally an hour and a half of just patting yourself in the back. And, I didn't want that for this. And the nice thing was, is talking to Chance and all of our conversations that we had, the thing that kept coming up was Perry, town, community, people helping each other, this and that. And finally, I figured some sort of structure, and I said, Chance, you know what this movie's missing? We need to tell the history of this little town and where the building blocks for this wrestling program came from, because it came from somewhere. But you just didn't start a wrestling program in high school, and boom, right. Here we are. It came from somewhere. And he wasn't too sure about it. Of course, first-time filmmaker. I said, dude, trust me, we need to tell the story about the town.
Yeah.
And he was kind of, and so finally, after we shot all the footage and everything else, I edited something together with, the little bit of history of the town. And same thing with him. It clicked.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, I get it now. And then once he saw how that segued into the next section and, reinforced that, then he was, I get it now. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Luckily, he was very open about a lot of the stuff that we were doing. So it gave me the freedom to go let me try this. Da, 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 da. And if it worked, it worked. If it didn't, all right, screw it. Let's cut it. I'm just going to sit there and push. Because my whole thing, you know, was telling a good, good story that is going to have longevity. Because that was my goal. Because, I mean, their wrestling program has been around for 42 years now. Wow. As far as winning. Because we didn't even talk about this. But the reason they even have a documentary is this little town since 1950, I should know this information. I just finished editing this damn thing. since 41 years ago, yeah, they have actually, if not won every single state championship, they've won every other one. Wow, so they've never gone more than 2 years without winning the state championship. That record never been broken. No other university, high school, anybody has a record like that where they either win consecutively or they just skip 1 year,
yeah,
and they don't win.
Wow.
You know? And so that's one of the things that I was looking at. This program has been around for so long. And in talking to a lot of these guys, a lot of the mentality has not changed. It's still the same mentality. It's, you know, suck it up, drive on, push harder type of stuff.
Yeah.
And so seeing the beauty in that consistency, I wanted this movie to have longevity. I didn't want it to be dated in any way. I didn't want it to be a huge pat on the back. So the way I laid it out in a way to where even if you didn't know a damn thing about wrestling and you weren't interested in wrestling at all, the story itself would make you go, oh, this is actually pretty interesting about this little town and what they've done and stuff like that. And I've had people on both sides that are big sports people that are, you know stats that you shouldn't know just because you need to fill your brain with something else.
Right. You're giving that space up to something that doesn't deserve.
Good
it.
On and trivia had, night, but
yeah, exactly. Or at the bar playing that game,
right? Yeah. Game.
And I've had friends that don't do sports at all. They're like us into filmmaking. They took drama class in high school and did band and shit, and get the same response. Man, this was so interesting. I was at the edge of my seat, wanting to know if they won or lost. And that's I was awesome. Like, cool. So it's like Hoosiers.
But a documentary, but a real life.
Hell yeah. And so, because that was my whole goal, is to make it to something that this little community 15, 20 years from now can watch it and everything still clicks and everything's still there. Yeah. You know, I wanted to use it as an inspirational piece for somebody that either wants to just get into wrestling, or isn't too sure about it, or wants to do something, maybe this film just inspires, not necessarily wrestling, because honestly, the way this is laid out, you can do this for anything, to be honest with you. The way it's laid out, you can, you know, it'll help you take that first step into wrestling or some other sport or shoot filmmaking where you're like, I don't know if I can do this, but you won't know until you actually do it.
Right.
Yeah. That's awesome. And so it's like killing it right now on Apple Movie, or is it Apple?
iTunes? It's on Apple. It's on iTunes, it's on Google Play, and I believe it's on YouTube also.
Isn't it in like the top 10 or something?
It was number 2 on iTunes? Yeah, iTunes for a while, and then I think it got up to number 2 also on Google Play, and then of course it dropped back down to like 37.
No big deal.
37. And you got, is it Trace Atkins who narrates?
Yes, Trace Atkins. That dude's voice just fit the whole documentary, just unbelievable.
Yeah, he nailed it.
Yeah, he was awesome. Actually, we got him thanks to Mike Stryker.
He's been doing music videos.
He's done quite a few of his videos.
Yeah, he does Trace Atkins' videos with Andrew Rosario, another great filmmaker down. They do both of Trace Atkins' videos, and you know, we were like, hey, you know Trace? Wink, wink, wink. You know, he was like, oh, let me ask him. Because we found out that Trace was into wrestling. Yeah. And it was funny, after we asked him, we found out it's not wrestling. He's into wrestling.
Wrestling.
Yeah.
That's that. Completely different
world. If you're in the South, you know what that is. Yeah. If you're not in the South, you're probably like somebody in New York going, what the hell is he talking about?
What's wrestling?
You got to be
What's
Southern. Wrestling? It's not wrestling. It's
If you don't know, they're pretty similar.
No, they're not.
But also very different.
Yeah.
They wear the same Speedos. That's about it.
Yeah. Now, you've done far more projects than just documentaries. I know we talked a lot about your documentaries, and we'll leave links to all of those in the show notes. But I would love to talk about one of the web series you share with us, the Masters of the Box.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
I got into that.
My series.
Oh, no. I might have to cut that one out. It's such a super interesting concept. And like, I love the approach of like this kind of blended voiceover of the what the players are doing at the table, similar to the Drunken History, which I think is how you kind of introduce it. But how did you get into that?
Actually, for most people that don't know what he's talking about, it's I basically took the concept of Drunk History as far as somebody telling the story and using their voice over the live action. And I took Critical Role. If you don't know what Critical Role is, it's a Dungeons & Dragons a series on YouTube where they literally sit at the table and play Dungeons & Dragons. And it's literally, there's no effects, there's no anime, there's nothing. It's literally people just sitting at the table playing.
Yeah, yeah.
And, but if you're into role-playing games, it's a whole lot of fun.
Yeah.
Well, love Drunk History. Huge fan of Drunk History. And one day I had just finished watching a bunch of Drunk History, got onto the computer, was doing some editing, and I had Critical Role playing in the background. Just kind of just sitting there. And, of course, when you're being creative, mine just kind of going, and all of a sudden I'm click, click, Drunk History, and, you know, Critical Role. And so I really started looking on how am I going to develop this, take this little concept. And so finally figured out the bugs, and I got a crew together, and I think it took us 5 weekends to do 6 episodes.
Okay.
Yeah, 6 episodes, but it's a whole lot of fun to watch.
It was, like, I really got into it. Just, I think that, like, the approach of, like, that similar, like, Drunk History, like, you know what's going on at the table, and, like, you see this interaction, but then when you cut to that live-action role-playing, and, like, they just, it was so well done. It was really good.
What a big part of that was the players at the table. The players at the table were not actors at all. Like in Critical Role, they're all voice actors. And of course, they've been playing Dungeons and Dragons for years, so they're very versed at doing voices and getting really into their characters. Which that's one of the things I love about the show. But the people that were on my series are not actors at all. Literally, just a bunch of nerds that love to play together and just love to play. And I said, you know what? Just be yourself.
Yeah,
that's a and it's funny because if you watched all the episodes, you can see that right at the beginning they were all really nervous. Yeah. And as
it's an authenticity.
Yeah. As they got more into the game, I can cameras and lights just disappeared and they were all in their own world.
In the game.
And you can see it as the show progresses. They really got into it. My favorite really is Kelsey Murphy. She plays Black Door, which is the dwarf fighter. Which she's a very pretty girl and. Black Door is this dwarf that's probably about 5 feet wide, about 4 feet tall. The actor that plays him is awesome. But she plays him. She does the voice for him. And she plays him with a Brooklyn accent, and she cusses like a sailor. It's awesome. It's awesome. Especially since you see, them both of them standing next to each other, Kelsey and Black Door. You're just like, wow, this is perfect. Yeah, everybody loves that character, but everybody had fun putting that together. It was a whole lot of fun. It was a lot of work, though. Yeah, because logistically, it's a nightmare.
Yeah, my question probably to that point is, on the day of filming the role-playing, like the actual production, I assume, like, are you giving all the actors the read at the table beforehand to learn it similar to, like, a song, or are you playing that as like live playback or both?
You mean on set?
Yeah.
As we're doing the live action? Yeah, no, what we did is the table stuff, we had an audio recording on set and basically did this lip sync to it, which was funny because the actors that I talked to, when we were talking to them, they said it was one of the easiest acting jobs they had because they didn't have to worry about, number one, truly remembering the lines, and then number two, concentrating on what emotion they were putting out because it's already there in the voice of the actor that's putting it out.
They just have to
redo it. And they said it was so easy to it was easier for them because they could concentrate on their mannerisms and other stuff.
It's like miming almost.
Yeah. And so they had a blast doing it, and I'm honestly wanting to put together, when we finished that up, it didn't hit as hard as I wanted to just because social media marketing is just kind of weird. And then we were supposed to have like a last minute investor come in and drop some money. And we're going to use that to get the social media marketing really way out there. And that didn't happen. And then like just as we were trying to gain traction, and Corona hits.
Oh yeah.
And so it was kind of this roller coaster of stuff. So, you know, luckily on a show like this and the content isn't one of those things that, you know, a year, 2 years from now, it's already passed and gone. You're not going to put it out there. And, you know, no, yeah. This is something that, you know, 5 years ago, people were still loving playing, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, doing nerd stuff. 5 years from now, people are still going to be going to conventions and stuff like that. So it's not anything. So I'm kind of like, I need to get out there, but at the same time, okay.
There's always going to be a market for it.
Yeah, there's definitely a market for it. Yeah. So. And especially the way it was done, it's a whole lot of fun. And, you know, one of the things that I got from the players at the table, it was funny because they were so over ecstatic to literally see their characters that has been nothing but on paper and in your imagination standing in front of you.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was one of the things. That's they were great. Like, this is so cool. They're like, I get to, you know, touch, you know, Blagd or Aoife or, you know, all the other characters. And they were just like, wow, this is so much fun.
That's a great concept.
See, what I'm hearing though is there's a chance there might be a season two.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. I'm working on trying to get season two together. Honestly, what I'm trying to do is get a big enough budget so we can do this the proper way. Because honestly, 6 30-minute episodes, which originally I was going to do 3 1-hour episodes, but because of YouTube, we need to get more content out there. So I broke it down into 6 30-minute episodes. But when we do this again, I want to have an actual budget for this and have longer episodes that are an hour long. To be honest with you, putting that project together, Jeffrey Turner, who was the other producer on the project, which he's an awesome dude, he came on board. He actually wrote the storyline for the actual adventure, and then Kevin Drury, who is the dungeon master, we handed him basically the storyline, and he turned it into the actual gameplay and everything else.
Yeah.
But damn it, I lost my train of thought again.
No, it's okay. This might be taboo for me to ask, but I'm curious just. And I'm sure others are, like, if they see that from a creative standpoint. Can you give me, like, a range of what the total budget was?
Oh, that's where I was getting at. Yeah. The three episodes, or not three episodes, 6 episodes, 30 minutes apiece. We did that on a $25,000 budget over 5 weekends.
5 weekends.
And to be honest with you, most of that budget went to craft and locations. Because everybody else that jumped on board was like, this is the coolest idea ever. I'm fucking here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like all the cameras that we got, they were free.
Yeah.
The See, guys that's jumped on it. Actually, we had to pay for Studio 615 because we used one of their back studios to shoot the gameplay to make it look really nice. Okay. We paid for that. Yeah, we paid for that. A few other little things. Actually, none of the actors or anybody got paid. Nobody on crew got paid. It's because of the concept. Everybody's like, dude, this is the coolest thing ever. Let's just do it.
That's one of the things we don't talk about enough is sometimes your concept is so attractive that people want to sign up and help out.
Actually, the best example of that is a short film that was done several years ago called The Butterfly Circus. It's a gorgeous film, man. It's this short film that was shopped around Hollywood for the longest time to try to get it out there. And, you know, for whatever reason, people were just not biting on it. And then somebody brought it up again, Chris, several years ago. And for some reason, everybody in Hollywood jumped on it. That was major. I want to say maybe it was during the writer strike that this happened, people weren't doing stuff.
Yeah.
And everybody saw the script. They loved it. But it's a gorgeous script. It's supposed to take place in the like 1940s. And so they had all the actual cars from that time and everything. Wow. And it's about this carnival that travels around the country and stuff like that. And it's called the Butterfly Circus. Well, they somehow end up at another carnival and see how really bad their performers are being treated and stuff like that. And then there's this one guy there who's a big actor. He actually has no limbs, no arms, no legs. And, of course, in that carnival, he's getting shit on all the time. And he basically escapes that carnival, comes to the Butterfly Circus, and basically they show him that he's worth more than what, you know, he is. And it's just a beautiful story. It was done so well that at the end of it, you just feel so good. It's one of those movies that will rip your heart out, make you cry, and at the end, it'll leave you smiling.
Put it back.
It's one of those films. It's a beautiful movie. If you get a chance to watch it, it's called The Butterfly Circus. It's been out for several years.
That's cool.
Yeah, great movie.
So out of all the things that you've done, editing, directing, producing, shooting, like what is the most creatively fulfilling for you of all those roles?
For me, directing. To be honest with you. I've been doing this 15 years now, I think.
Yeah.
And when it comes to editing, I'm kind of to that point where I'm just kind of burnt out.
Yeah, I hear you.
To that point, yeah. And honestly, people go through it all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, I got a buddy now, right now. He's been doing tons and tons of YouTube videos for the last couple of years. And he's to that point where he's just like, I'm over these damn YouTube videos to the point where I don't even want to edit them, but I got to pay bills. Yeah. And then when you get something new, no matter what it is, you're like, oh, hell yeah. Like, what was it? There for the longest time, a few years back, I was doing nothing but country music. Just country music here and there.
Oh, man.
Of course, it's paying the bills.
I feel that.
Yeah,
that's,
and I'm
that's
like.
That's the Nashville experience, yeah. Everybody.
And I'm to the point where I'm like, oh, not another country song. Yeah. And then Zach brought me a project through GABA Entertainment. Remember they were doing their ugly Christmas sweater party? Remember, yes. Well, they were having me cut a promo for them, and they wanted me to use some EDM to cut it and cut it like a music video. Nice. They brought that to me, and I was like, what? I was like, hell yeah.
Yes.
I sat there, had a blast with it, because even just listening to the different beats and editing to a completely different type of beat was just so much fun. I was like, oh, I can do fast edits instead of shit.
Yeah. That's the Nashville experience, truly, when you work in production, is how many country videos have you worked on as an editor?
Luckily, the music scene is definitely, it continues to evolve.
Oh, yeah, like
it's diverse, but
now but several years ago, no, it was literally just,
To be fair, I've only done a handful of country videos. Most of what I've done has been rock and rock.
I guess I've been fortunate that it's been like more pop country, more like modern.
Yeah, you've done more country, like newer country than I ever did.
But it's not like 90s country.
No. I don't think anybody's doing that anymore.
I mean, it exists.
Yeah, it exists. Yeah.
Nobody I know is shooting that.
So what's been in your 15 years of doing this or more, like what's been, would you say your biggest failure creatively? Or like a lesson that you learned.
Biggest lesson you learned.
Biggest fuck up.
Yeah. What's the biggest fuck up you've had? Right. What did you learn from that?
What did you learn?
Don't trust that producer that's dangling that carrot in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
You do this for free, we'll make millions.
Exposure bucks.
Yeah.
Exposure. You know how many times I've heard that, hey, I got a project, and I don't got the money, but we put it together, and I can get it sold.
But we'll give you credit.
Yeah, we'll give you credit. I'll give you credit for it. Bitch, I got credit. Recently I had somebody approach me that, hey, I got this project, blah, 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 blah. You know, you can add it to your, it'll be a wonderful credit to you. Yeah. I sent him a picture of me holding my fucking Emmy. Don't need the credit, dude.
Yeah, yeah.
Here it is. It was funny because my wife is in the background. I took it. I'm like being silly, smiling, thumb up.
But now in the past, I feel like that is a lesson you've learned because you did that, right?
Oh, yeah.
We've all done that, yeah. Somebody dangles that right carrot. You're like, oh, okay, I can do it. I had a company years ago did that to me, kept dangling that carrot. Oh, you know, and they were doing stuff at the Hard Rock. And they had a couple of days at the Hard Rock where they would bring artists and they would perform. And they did a lot of stuff around town, set up stages and this and that. And the owner was like, oh, hey, you know, do this for me. You know, and he was always paying like crap. Oh, I'll pay $150. But, you know, this goes, you know,
when the charts will
hit big, yeah, we'll get a big music video, okay. Yeah. So after about a year and a half of just that, I was just like, no. Actually, he called me one day, and I had done a EPK for one of the artists, and what is it? Oh, it was a weird situation, because normally we do all the business through the record label.
Yeah.
And boom, it's done there. Well, this time, everything went to the artist, so the artist paid me directly. And, you know, the label was, or they were basically like, just, you know, do it, take care of it. And, you know, the artist, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay. So we do everything. And just as I'm finishing up the EPK, you know, I get an email from them that says, hey, send us the video for final approval, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, so I thought about it for a second. I'm like, okay, they didn't pay, the client paid, so I got to get permission from them to make sure final approval is okay from them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I said to them, I said, hey, email them, hey, you know, send me, have the artist just send me a quick, you know, email saying, hey, it's cool that they have final approval. And the only reason I'm saying that is because they paid, not they paid. You guys. So technically they're the client. Well, I get back this email. Who the fuck do you think you are? Question me, blah, blah, blah. That's my artist, blah, 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 blah. So I just, you know, at that point I was just like, screw this. I'm not going anywhere with these people. I fired right back. I said, you know what? I don't talk to you like that, so don't fucking talk to me like that. I was, as far as I'm concerned, fuck you and fuck your artist. I haven't talked to him since. And guess what? I'm doing just fine. I've won several awards since, and then they're still doing the same fucking thing.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing about living in Nashville in certain cities. You get a lot of snakes in the grass.
Yeah.
That's the one thing in this industry. You really, really do. And it's one of those things you learn as you're coming up to spot them, you know?
You got to watch out.
Oh, yeah, big time. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, we've all had it. I'm pretty sure you've heard stories from Zach and Mike. And
I've had my own. Oh, you know? Like, we've all been there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, it's part of it. It's part of coming up, you know. You learn it. You hope you learn from it.
Right,
don't get screwed too hard.
It's part of your hazing, man.
Yeah. Like Tim Vandesteek said, you know, you're going to get fucked. You just have to realize how big or how little you're going to get fucked.
Exactly. I miss that dude, man.
Yeah,
he used to literally call me every single morning. Hey, how's it going? What are you up to, Tim? Well, it's 5 o'clock here in L.A. I'm out for my morning walk, and I already had my coffee. I'm like, Jesus Christ!
I've already put a treatment together.
Yeah, exactly. Like I had an idea for a treatment, so I just put it together this morning as I was drinking my coffee.
Holy crap. Went out to L.A. with Zach a couple of years before he passed away, and we had dinner with him. And we were at his place briefly, and he just had all this concept art up on the wall, and he was like, I'm working on this sci-fi thing, and I was just impressed by the amount of work that dude just, like, put together and was always just thinking about something. He's like, I got this happening, and just no bullshit, just after it.
Very definitely. Impressive. Filmmaking was a priority unless it came to the Vikings.
The Vikings.
He dropped everything for the Vikings. It didn't matter it was.
Big fans of other love.
He could have had a meeting with Spielberg. He'd be like, nope, it's the Vikings.
It was a Vikings game.
Yeah. Vikings game. I'll call you after the game.
So speaking of lessons learned, if you could give any piece of advice to someone who's trying to get into the business, what would that be?
You have to be completely insane to be in this business.
I agree with that.
Yeah. You have to have issues.
And just come to terms with that.
Just come to terms with that.
Yeah.
And just come to terms that you're going to put your issues on the screen.
Embrace it.
Embrace it.
Yeah. Make money off of it somehow.
That's awesome. Honestly, the best advice is no matter how hard things get, just keep going, man.
Yeah.
Because there's been many times, trust me, that I got to that point where I'm like, screw this. I'm done with filmmaking. I'm going to go do something else.
Yeah.
And then, you just keep pushing. And then another project comes along that, you know, puts you in a better place.
Gets you reinvigorated. Yeah. Or gets you really bought in.
Yeah. So I guess now, since I've been doing it for so long, it's like I'm to that point where I just pick and choose my projects. I don't want to do that.
It's a good place to be.
You know, I don't want to do that project. Why not? It'll be done. No.
Yeah. I'm good.
But da-da-da-da, no.
No. No.
You need me. I don't need you. Nice. Keeping it real, man. Keeping it real.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Is it lightning round time?
I think so.
Lightning round.
Dun, dun, dun.
We still don't have a cool intro.
No. Dun, someday. Dun, dun. I think our intro is just...
It's just us we don't have an intro. Yeah.
All right. Are you ready?
Ready. Not really. Quickly.
All-time favorite movie?
I don't have one. I really don't. And the only reason why is there's so many great movies in different genres.
Yeah.
I can never pick just one. Like, for as far as documentaries, one of my favorite documentaries to watch is What the Bleep Do We Know? You ever seen that?
No.
I've heard of it before.
It's really good. It talks about sacred geometry and, you know.
A bunch of
really wild stuff.
Yeah.
I like that. But then I also like really, really indie films like Hobo with the Shotgun.
I've heard of that.
Hobo with the Shotgun's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
And then like Black Dynamite.
Okay. Yes.
Yeah. See, stuff like that. And then also that. Like really like epic stuff. Like one of my favorite like epic type of movies to watch if I got like 3 or 4 hours to kill, it's like Dance of the Wolves.
Oh, man.
I love Dance of the Wolves.
Yeah.
Like, to me, that's a gorgeous epic. And then I also like classic movies. Like literally 2 weeks ago, I sat down and watched Pell Rider. With Clint Eastwood.
Yeah.
Hell Rider. And then I think I watched The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
Of course, sometimes I hate watching old movies as a filmmaker because you're like, oh, that's just so bad. Why did you do that?
They didn't know back then.
Yeah, they didn't. Yeah, that's what I mean. They were which is funny because I went to back and watched, tried watching Knight Rider. I got 2 episodes into it, and I had to stop. The continuity on that thing was just so all over the place. Terrible. I was just cringing. And then the storyline, I'm like, why was this even
popular? Everything else, so much work went into it.
Oh, yeah,
yeah.
Like, you just got to respect that grind.
But the funny thing is, though, everything else that was on TV at the time was at the same level.
Yeah.
A-Team was at the same level. Dukes of Hazzard with the same level. Same, you know?
That's crazy you bring up the A-Team. I'd strongly consider, like, I wonder if I could go back and binge watch that.
It'd be rough.
It'd be a little bit tough.
Yeah, because it tends to, not so necessarily campy, but.
Yeah.
I mean, because literally, out of all the A-Team episodes that I've watched, as much shooting as they do, they never hit anybody. How the fuck are you going to be Special Forces guys, Delta Force?
Never shoot a single
killing machines. Hey, you never. But I mean, they can build like a watercraft out of an old boat and some barbed wire, but they couldn't hit a damn side of a barn. What the hell is wrong with them?
That's true.
They had Mr. T though.
They did. It was all that gold chain, line of people.
That's similar, like guys that are like really into guns or former military, and they're watching movies and like. I haven't seen you reload once.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, you recognize it really quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, I love the John Wick movies, but being military, I'm like, dude, that gun doesn't hold 50 bullets.
Yeah.
No. But it's great for cinema.
Like, I get it. Like, he's a really fast reload, but I didn't see it.
Right.
Yeah. It didn't happen.
Actually, Val Kilmer had the fastest reload in the movie for the longest time up until recently.
Which movie?
That was Heat.
Oh.
The bank scene.
Well, Heat is like Heat's they tried wrong. For realism in Heat.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they really went for it.
Yeah. Well, it's a split-second scene. He's literally, they're getting shot at by the cops, and he's behind a car, and he's shooting forward, and he runs out of ammo, and somebody shoots from behind him. He turns around, and he literally goes click, 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 pop, 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 that quick, and... To date, that was that. Right up until I think last year, he had the fastest magazine change in the movie. So, John Wick beat him up.
Yeah, shocker.
Yeah, dude. So, but he
actually changed magazine.
You're right. Yeah. But he had the record for the longest time. Wow. It's funny, movie records, too.
Yeah. I mean, Keanu put in hours at Terran Tactical.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's legit.
Like some impressive stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then followed all those up with another Bill and Ted.
which I heard was really good.
I watched it. Actually, a lot of people didn't like the last Bill and Ted, but if you're a huge fan of the first two, it has that same feel.
Yeah, that's
it
what I
that
heard.
Same flow. Yeah. It's everything. Yes, it is difficult looking at Keanu Reeves and going, no, that's not Ted, because Ted is not this giant dude that's all muscle bound.
Yeah,
Ted's this. Skater looking kid that's you know
Ted's
scrawny. Ted, but
Ted's not John Wick without facial hair.
But he makes it happen though. I mean, it's you do get to a certain point in the movie, you're like, okay, that's Ted. But at first you're just like I still keep seeing John Wick. I'm waiting for him to just pop 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 start killing everybody.
When does The Vengeance come out?
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. Last movie that you watched.
Last movie that I watched was Jesus, what did I watch? I've been binge watching TV shows lately.
Okay.
So let me see.
Last TV series you got into.
You're going to laugh at me. I was just watching The Vampire Diaries.
I'll reserve my judgment.
Hey, if it's good, it's good, right?
Yeah. All right. Do you have a favorite director?
Actually, no. Same thing with movies is there's so many great directors out there that I don't have one. But then, again, I've never been that type of person. I don't have a favorite sports team. I don't have a favorite musician. I don't have a favorite town. I don't have favorite nothing. Yeah. I just kind of...
Just here for
know,
it all. Just,
yeah, like as far as directors go, I love Darren Aronofsky. He's a fucking nut. Oh, yeah. The stuff that he comes with. I like Oliver Stone, you know. I like the way he thinks and the way his storytelling is. Actually, I was working on a script right before Corona hit where I was taking the whole concept that Oliver Stone did with Natural Born Killers and, you know, using projectors on the walls to project images and things like that.
Yep.
Same, similar concept, but in another movie that I was working on.
Nice.
Nice.
So, but yeah, Oliver Stone. Also like, what is it? Of course, you're big time, big name directors, you're Spielberg and stuff like that. Cause those guys made all the movies that I grew up with.
Right. So influential. Not like him?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I grew up with all those E.T., yeah. Arachnophobia. I mean, Ghostbusters. I'm kind of leery about the new Ghostbusters just because I'm like,
I think it's going to be good.
I hope so. I hope it's
going to be good.
Yeah. Cause that's last Ghostbusters with the girls. I didn't. Yeah.
It was the script with that. That script is.
Yeah.
Actually, for me, it would have been quite a bit better if, what's his face? Hemsworth?
Chris Hemsworth.
Chris Hemsworth.
Yeah.
If they hadn't made him so stupid, I think that would have been better because.
There was enough comedic relief.
Yeah, there was. Yeah. But also, Janine was not stupid. Janine was New York. She was tough. She gave you attitude.
Yeah.
So I was kind of expecting the similar thing with him to him just to be a hot bod and stupid, where the girls are like, oh my God, you so hot. I was kind of like.
That was cringy. That was a little far off.
Source material. I wish they would have made him more like Janine, or brought in a female to play that character and just made her more like Janine. You know, or hell, that would have been cool if they were like, this is Janine's daughter. That would have been cool to tie in, you know, the original Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
What about cinematographers?
Cinematographers, no.
All right.
One of my favorite cinematographers here locally is Josh Reeve.
Josh is great.
I've worked with him quite a bit, but as far as like Hollywood cinematographers now, but as far as here locally goes, I mean, my favorite go-to guys are Josh Reeve and Stryker. I mean, those are my go-to guys. Yeah. Actually, I got another buddy that I do a lot of work with. You probably know him, Andy Burchett.
I've met him once.
Yeah. He doesn't do as much DP as he used to. He kind of has taken a step back. He's been doing a lot more camera work on reality shows. Time I talked to him was a few weeks back, and he was working on Property Brothers.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he was running around with them. Yeah. And then after he was getting done with them, he was supposed to be jumping on a bus with Big Kenny, Big and Rich, and they're supposed to be doing something together.
Nice.
All right, we'll line it up a little bit. Coffee or tea?
Beer.
Excellent choice.
Excellent choice. But if I have to choose coffee with Maker's Mark.
All right. Pineapple on your pizza?
On some pizzas. Only if it's Hawaiian.
You are losing, Corey.
Mm-hmm. I know.
Corey's not a fan.
You can't have it just on the plain pepperoni. You can't have it on a supreme. It has to be like the Hawaiian with the ham, and the pepper and the pineapple.
I agree.
All right, I'll give it a try.
You should. We should do it on the show. It a try.
Oh, we could. We should give up a film school Friday for a Feed Corey Pizza Friday.
Yes, feed your crew.
Nice. All right. Favorite camera?
The one the client can afford.
This guy produces.
Yes.
Good answer. I just bought a Blackmagic Pocket 4K.
Okay.
About a month ago. So I kind of played with it a little bit, loving the look on it. Haven't really gotten just deep into it, but everything that I've seen so far, footage on it's awesome.
Yeah.
Nice. And I ended up picking up some really inexpensive Shinon lenses from they're cinematic lenses from the 70s, and they're stupid dirt cheap. They're Japanese knockoffs of some like really nice lenses, and I come to find out that the guts to these things are actually Pentex glass and guts.
Oh wow!
Yeah, so they're
and then this company just rehoused them or rebranded them. No,
I think
they,
I think back in the '70s,
probably just
Pentex actually made them for Shinon. They were basically subcontracted. And okay. They got out there, so they were. Of course, stuff was built way different back in the '70s.
Yeah,
built to last.
Yeah,
and so they basically just put them out and. Here recently, they've been kind of surfacing up again as awesome. Being really, really good, inexpensive. Put it to you this way: I got five lenses, from a 28 millimeter all the way to a 200 millimeter, and everything in between, for less than $600.
Oh wow!
Wow.
Well, here's the thing, though: you have to get an adapter because you know how your what is it?
Is it the
Micro Four Thirds? No, I had to get an adapter from Micro Four Thirds to M42 screw-on.
Oh, they're
because the Shinons are M42 screw-ons. So, but it looks awesome.
I'll have to check them out. I'm a big tech nerd, so I'm gonna.
I hear recently I've started getting into like vintage lenses.
Yeah,
yeah. Some of them
we've got some '70s lenses.
Yeah,
that's another reason I picked up
a set of Leica R's.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
that's another reason I picked up the Pocket 4K because it's very versatile on. What types of lenses?
A lot of adaptability.
Yeah, just for shits and giggles, I got onto B&H Photo the other day and was looking at Micro Four Thirds cinematic Zeiss lenses, just sitting there drooling, looking at my screen. The cheapest one was $5,600. I'm like,
yeah.
Yeah. One day.
Better off renting those.
One day. Dude, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I'd like to say, like, I own
Zeiss. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
You'd get a lot more gigs, probably.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
As long as you charge for them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
I just don't have $100,000 to drop on a whole set of lenses that you need. But you're right. Yeah, go rent them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Three films everyone should see before they die.
Three films everyone should see before they die. That would be Dog Day Afternoon. Very good movie.
Good one.
If you haven't seen it, you suck. I love the classics. Another great cinematic movie that you have to watch just for fun would be The Dirty Dozen.
Okay.
Dirty Dozen. And then here recently, I'm picking a new film that I had a lot of fun watching was Hidden Figures.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That was a great movie.
That was so good.
Yeah, it was a really, really good movie. Yeah. I mean, there's so many movies that I like. Dude, I like Thunderheart. You ever seen that with Val Kilmer?
Oh, yeah.
Where he's an FBI agent and there's a murder on a reservation. And get him on there and he's supposed to be like half Native American, but he looks like Johnny Knoxville from, you know, Notre Dame. He doesn't like shit. I look nothing Native American. But that's actually a really, really good movie. That actually came out around the time that there was a lot of Native American movies coming out. Yeah. There was Dances with Wolves came out. Thunderheart came out, and then one of my actually, no, I'm changing one of those answers.
Okay, all right.
Smoke Signals.
Okay.
You're seeing that? Mm-hmm. It was, up until that time, it was the very first movie written, produced, directed, and starring all Native Americans.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Smoke Signals. Great movie. It's about, what would you call it, coming-of-age movie, kind of?
Probably.
Yeah. About two guys that, one of the guys, his dad dies. And they basically got to make this journey to bury his dad. And it's, you know, them making this journey.
Nice.
Yeah, it's actually a really, really good movie. It's called Smoke Signals.
That's cool.
That's your list. I'll include whatever you want.
Nice.
Sergio, it's been great.
Thanks for coming on.
I know you guys have known each other for a while. It was great to get to meet you and hang out for a little while.
Yeah, it was fun. Yeah. It's been forever since I've been on the podcast.
Well, I'm glad.
Welcome back.
I'm glad we could reintroduce you to the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
we'll leave links to all of your all your projects, all of the stuff we talked about today. We'll leave all those links in the show notes for our listeners. We know you have a lot of podcast options. We appreciate you choosing us. If you like what you heard today, go ahead and leave us a like, leave us a little subscribe maybe. And if you're on Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating. It would help us out a ton.
It would.
And until next time,
feed your crew.
Feed them something.
Hawaiian pizza.
Maybe at the wrap party.